I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, we'll have a snapshot of the presidential campaign. What role is race playing? But first, baseball great Roger Clemens faced his former trainer, Brian McNamee, in Washington today at hearings over allegations of steroid and human growth hormone, or HGH, use in baseball. In a nationally broadcast congressional hearing, Clemens once again denied that he ever used performance-enhancing drugs.
I've been accused of something I'm not guilty of. How do you prove a negative? No matter what we discuss here today, I'm never going to have my name restored. But I've got to try and set the record straight. Brian McNamee's statements about me are wrong. Let me be clear. I have never taken steroids or HGH.
Clemens was sitting just inches from McNamee, who claims he injected Clemens with the drugs up to 21 times over 4 years.
While I liked and admired Roger Clemens, I don't think that I ever really trusted him. Maybe my years as a New York City police officer had made me wary. But I just had the sense that if this ever blew up and things got messy, Roger would be looking out for number one.
But perhaps the most damaging words came from someone who wasn't even there. Clemens' friend and fellow Yankee teammate Andy Pettitte told investigators that Clemens had admitted to him nearly 10 years ago that he had used human growth hormones. Well, joining us with more on all of this, Dan Shaughnessy, sports columnist with the Boston Globe. He's in Fort Myers, Florida, where spring training's about to begin for the Red Sox there. But Dan, it would seem that these were pretty explosive words from Andy Pettitte. They were leaked last night. You know, how much of a bombshell is that?
Oh, I think it's very damaging to the Clemens case. This is not a trial, but people are going to make up their minds based on what they see in the hearings today. It's pretty clear a lot of the congressmen have made up their minds based on one thing or another as they ask questions of both people. But the Pettitte stuff is a smoking gun. It really hurts Clemens' argument here.
Well, it is. He said. But it is pretty, damning. And we were wondering yesterday here on the program why Andy Pettitte had been excused from the hearings. He was supposed to be sitting right next to Roger Clemens. It would seem now that might have been way too uncomfortable. He gave the sworn affidavit saying he didn't want to denounce Clemens in the glare of the national spotlight. Today, Democratic Congressman Elijah Cummings of Maryland brought up Pettitte's testimony and directed it to Clemens. Let's listen.
In his deposition, Mr. Pettitte told the committee that he had a conversation with you in 1999 or 2000 in which you admitted that you used human growth hormones. Is this true?
It is not.
So you did not tell Mr. Pettitte that you used human growth hormones?
I did not.
But at the same time, you just said that he's a very honest fellow. Is that right?
I believe Andy to be a very honest fellow, yes.
Very well. Let's continue.
Well, it went on from there, but didn't come to any conclusion. Dan Shaughnessy, what is happening here? I mean, why would Andy Pettitte, who has, by the way, acknowledged that he used, the HGH, the injections, why would he say this about Clemens?
Well, this goes back to the entire McNamee case. You know, McNamee is the star witness for the Mitchell Report. He has testified that he administered steroids to Chuck Knobloch, Andy Pettitte, and Roger Clemens. Chuck Knobloch and Andy Pettitte, under oath, have agreed with this. They have said it's true. It's just you can't get your arms around this. Why he would tell the truth about them and then fabricate this ridiculous myth lie about Roger Clemens. It doesn't make any sense. And it's very damaging for the Clemens argument on this.
Well, but Roger Clemens did say that he felt Andy Pettitte misremembered the conversation.
And again, there's inconsistencies in that because Roger has owned up to the idea that his wife experimented with HGH. And Andy Pettit's wife has testified that she remembers her husband telling of these conversations. This is not he said. He said it's a lot of people against Clemens,
and that's
what he's got up against him right now.
Oh, but as you said, it is sort of a smoking gun, but it isn't concrete evidence, and there may be some of that. McNamee claims he injected Clemens with steroids at least 12 times and at least 4 times with HGH. He also handed over syringes and gauze that he said were used when he injected Clemens. And Representative Dan Burton, a Republican from Indiana, said to McNamee point blank he didn't believe him. So, are these things going to be tested to see what they are?
Or? I'm sure, Robin, you can tamper with evidence. It's old stuff. I don't know how much there is to that. And Representative Dan Burton clearly is a blatant Clemens sympathizer. He talked about what a titan in baseball Roger Clemens was. I think he had Texas cufflinks on. He was he was extremely aggressive toward McNamee, and certainly he's allowed to be that way. But I Roger Clemens paraded through the halls of Congress and met 24 of the 40 people in this committee over the last 2 weeks, which in my view is a disgraceful allowance that congressmen agreed to let them do that. I didn't see Brian McNamee going door to door to meet and greet with these guys, sign autographs, pose for pictures with staff. And it's pretty clear to me which guys have been impacted by that. And I would submit that Representative Burton would be one of those.
Well, you know, and some would say that's why they might have felt uncomfortable. We said yesterday their inner baseball players might have felt uncomfortable making two baseball players sit next to each other, but some were hoping for that moment to clarify things, meaning Andy Pettit. But so what happens now? I mean, where does this go?
Well, they have said, the committee chairman has said this would be the last steroid hearing they expect. The only thing left, Robin, on this is who you believe and if there's any criminal prosecution of people for perjury, and that would be either Brian McNamee or Roger Clemens. If clearly the feds have decided they think that McNamee is telling the truth, that's why the Mitchell report was released with the stamp of the federal government, federal prosecutors, there's three of them there today in the courtroom, and if they think Clemens is lying to them, as with Marion Jones, as with Barry Bonds, they'll go after him on that.
And it could potentially be, you know, now familiar ending to the story. It's not the, you know, it's the cover-up, not the...
It's not using the steroids. It's lying to the feds about it. They don't like that. They frown on that. They like to set examples about that. And someone clearly is lying here because the stories are too divergent.
Dan Shaughnessy, sports columnist with the Boston Globe. Dan, thanks so much for weighing in.
Always a pleasure, Robin.
Well, it's on to Hawaii, Wisconsin, Rhode Island, Vermont, Texas, and Ohio after yesterday's Potomac primaries. John McCain firmed up his lead on the Republican side, Mike Huckabee admitting he'll need a miracle to pass the senator, but vowing to stay in the race till the magic number of 1,191 delegates needed to lock up the Republican nomination. McCain has at least 700 to Huckabee's 241. On the Democratic side, Barack Obama now leads in delegates and states, although Hillary Clinton still leads in superdelegates. Party operative pledged votes, and both are in a statistical dead heat in national polls. Ken Walsh is chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. He joins us from Washington. We want to take a look at this snapshot in time, Ken. You talked to Barack Obama. Now, today, pundits are, you know, all talking about how he made inroads yesterday into women voters, rural voters, white male voters. But you say he told you he has a strategy that may be playing out here of approaching Republican voters?
Yes, I was somewhat surprised by this, that he would be so blunt about this at this point while the nomination is still contested, because remember when he praised Ronald Reagan's political skills some time ago, Bill and Hillary Clinton jumped on that as an example that he's not a real mainstream Democrat. In fact, he mentioned Reagan again when I interviewed him on Monday afternoon. He saw these big victories coming on Tuesday, and I think he felt comfortable sort of expanding his sense of outreach. But I took this to indicate he was really very confident on how this is all going for him. He's won eight in a row now of primaries and caucuses, and he talks now freely about wooing Republicans who he calls Obamicans.
Well,
so he's got a little phrase for it.
Well, and it would seem as if John McCain is aware of that. They seem to be taking swipes at each other. Obama saying McCain is a hero, but his are bound to be the failed policies of the past. Well, McCain didn't mention Barack Obama yesterday, but did say to encourage a country without new rhetoric, without sound and proven ideas that trust in the strength and courage of free people. It's not a promise of hope. It's a platitude. Is this the beginning, perhaps, of him directing his Republicans and directing their attention directly to Barack Obama?
Well, I think you'll see some of that. I think you'll see McCain sort of bouncing between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in his criticisms. But I'm actually struck by how mild the to-ing and fro-ing has been between McCain and Obama. When I talked to Obama, he seemed very respectful of McCain's service, which he did repeat in his speech last night, sort of his victory speech, talking about him being a hero, and talked about how he wanted to keep sort of a civil tone. And McCain has talked about that, too.
Well, interesting you mentioned that. We're going to, in just a couple of minutes, talk about, you know, what role, if any, right now, race is playing in the on the Democratic side, and maybe on the Republican as well, because we want to raise the question there that perhaps white men might have more difficulty attacking a black male than they would a white woman.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you look at these numbers, it is very striking how in the breakdowns, Obama is doing very well among white men. And he's actually doing better among white women, too, although white women are still very supportive of Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And, you know, dissecting that is kind of difficult now. I think that, you know, our race problem, the heritage of slavery and segregation has been an awful stain on the country. But Obama is trying to define that race issue much differently, almost as an immigration issue.
Well, speaking of which, you just want to jump in to say that Hillary Clinton supporters say it is far from over, that they knew February was going to be tough. They're looking ahead to March, Ohio, Texas, where they feel they're going to get the Hispanic vote far more than he does. And on the Republican side, I just want to, you know, make sure we've weighed in there. It was nail-biting last night.
Yes.
Mike Huckabee did quite well. If it weren't winner-take-all for the Republicans, might he still be far more in the race?
Well, you know, he is, you know, at this point, the concern among the McCain side is that he's sort of a spoiler that raises difficult issues that McCain would rather deal with privately with these conservative leaders. And you're right, it was a nail-biter, particularly in Virginia, where it looked like it was going to be neck and neck. Now, McCain did pull ahead, and looks like he got about 50% of the vote in the end. So he did win convincingly. But he does have a serious problem now still with the conservative wing of the party, and, you know, particularly with social conservatives, to some extent economic conservatives.
And just briefly, why is that? Because we've been reporting all along that independents are, in many cases, choosing between Barack Obama and John McCain. John McCain, for instance, is against Roe v. Wade, wants to put judges in place who would remove it. Why is he, why isn't that coming across?
Well, yeah, he does. I mean, when I've talked to the conservative activist community, and we have to distinguish between them and rank-and-file conservatives, the activists being much more intensely opposed to McCain. But that does then spill over into the Rush Limbaugh world and the conservative talk radio and so on. So I'm not minimizing this. But their concern about these social issues is that McCain just has not been a leader on them. He's been with them, like you say, on the abortion issue, but he hasn't talked about it a lot. He hasn't focused on it. And so they don't know if they can really trust him to pursue their social conservative agenda if he's president, as they feel he has not done on some of the economic issues where he opposed the president's tax cuts in the first term and was on the wrong side, according to the activists, of the immigration issue. So there's a matter of trust of McCain, whether he'd really deliver and whether the social issues in particular would be high on his agenda if he were president. That causes a lot of anxiety and opposition in the conservative community.
Kim Walsh of U.S. News and World Report on the presidential primaries. And boy, can it just, it keeps on keeping on. Thanks so much for touching base with us.
Thank you.
And we'll have more on this day after Virginia, Maryland, D.C. after a break. Back in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now, and it seemed like a good place in the presidential campaign to take a look at the role of race. Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell told the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette editorial board that he felt white Pennsylvanians would vote against Barack Obama because he's black. He cited his own 2006 reelection when he beat former Steelers player Lynn Swann. He said if Swann had been white, he'd have won by 17 points. So what role is race playing? We're joined by Frederick Harris, director of the Center for African American Politics and Society at Columbia University. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, we've heard some of the statistics in Maryland and Virginia yesterday. Barack Obama won 84-90% of the black vote. In Virginia, he got more of the white vote than Senator Clinton, 52-47%. Also, he seemed very popular in the voting with college-educated white men. Did your research show these trends approaching, or are you surprised? How are you reacting to some of this?
Well, I'm very surprised in many ways. This has been a very unconventional election year. Barack Obama has been doing extraordinarily well since South Carolina, and it's been there where he's picked up considerable black support, that is. He did very well in Georgia. He did well in Alabama. And he's been getting over 80% of the black vote since South Carolina. And among white voters, he's been cutting into Senator Clinton's support base, and I think that's going to have huge consequences as we look forward in the primary.
Well, and just looking back a little bit more, we remember in Iowa, Barack Obama didn't do well at all in rural areas, for instance, and then did very well in those areas yesterday. And we were hearing early on, there was a lot of reporting about how black voters in particular, and particularly in the South, were saying they liked him very much, didn't like the prospect of an African-American president, but they were worried about voting him, that he would be harmed, for instance. What do you think has happened?
I think Iowa and even the second place showing in New Hampshire sent a strong signal to black voters about his viability. But what's been curious about this whole election is that Barack Obama, as well as Senator Clinton, I would add, have not appealed to black voters based on the issues that disproportionately affect black communities, questions around poverty, predatory lending practices, which disproportionately affect black communities.
Some are saying that with John Edwards out of the race, a lot of those issues of poverty are gone.
Oh, they are, which is curious because these are sort of bedrock Democratic Party issues, and black voters traditionally have supported candidates who support those issues. So what we see now is a rallying around the symbolicness of Barack Obama's candidacy. And I think that's the surprising element in this race, at least for me.
Well, is that a problem, too? Because we spoke earlier today to Professor Carol Swain. She is a black woman who's supporting Mike Huckabee. And she said to us today that she feels that Barack Obama is getting a pass. He's not getting asked the tough questions that, for instance, Hillary Clinton is being asked.
No, I wouldn't say that. I don't think, I think both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are both getting passes if we consider evaluating them on traditional Democratic issues. You know, traditional Democratic voters, black voters, are not demanding more of these candidates around these issues.
What do you make of the fact that in Maryland and Virginia, Barack Obama won heavily with college-educated white men? Clinton won those, you know, without college degrees. But this idea of college-educated white men drifting with African Americans to Barack Obama. Some have read into that. Your thoughts?
This is a very unconventional year. Who would have thought, right? But I think there's a generational shift that's going on here. Many people talk about, you know, what's the implications of a white electorate in the post-civil rights era, particularly as we look at the so-called hip-hop generation, where at least culturally there's been much more racial integration or multiracial integration. And perhaps their socialization, particularly these younger male voters, around issues of race, may indicate a sea change in American politics. Now, the question is, what does that mean for women? Because, you know, we're also in the post-women's movement era.
Mm-hmm.
And so the consequences of this, civil rights, the women's movement, what that means for white male voters when they think about their preferences is a question I think scholars will be pondering for years to come.
Well, let's ponder it just a little bit now, because it's funny you mentioned we've been picking up on some language just in the last couple of days. Right-leaning, or at least McCain-leaning radio commentators, Don Imus comes to mind, seeming to feel the need to express their civil rights credentials, saying, for instance, well, if Barack Obama could put a face on America that would signal to the world that we've healed some wounds, that wouldn't be such a bad thing. I mean, these are people who, you know, vilify Hillary Clinton. And I'm wondering, is it going to be harder for these white men to attack Barack Obama, who would seem to be the opposition candidate, than it would be for them to attack Hillary Clinton? And they seem to have no problem with that.
Well, first of all, if I was Don Imus, I would be concerned about my own.
Don Imus in particular, you're right.
But looking beyond Mr. Imus, you know, I'm wondering whether this is, we're in a moment of a feel-good moment that, you know, particularly as Obama is matched against Hillary Clinton, who half of the country see her in a very negative light. But when things shift with McCain in the fall, when there begins to be an emphasis on experience, I wonder if we're going to see a shift toward John McCain as the candidate. And sort of this feel-good moment we see in the primaries may be eroding as we look toward November.
I think what you're hearing is that perhaps you can't imagine these same people wanting so badly to participate in a feel-good moment
mm-hmm.
about a woman.
Mm-hmm.
As they might about a black man.
I mean, one has to look back and see and have a really interesting discussion about the movements where these candidates emerged from, the civil rights movement and the women's movement. And the question is, has the civil rights movement been much more successful in incorporating black people within American life than the women's movement?
A question that will be sure to be parsed as well. Frederick Harris is director of the Center for African American Politics and Society at Columbia University. Thanks for helping us take this snapshot.
Sure.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, can President Bush put his plan for providing long-term security for Iraq in place without congressional approval? If he does, it'll be a first. Also, online dating. Some sites have now replaced browsing through photos with scientific algorithms and questionnaires. Why is it important for them to know the length of your index finger? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, what is the state of marriage? It's just fine. In fact, better than ever, but your great-great-great-great-grandmother would not recognize it. That's still to come after the news, Here and Now. Tomorrow is Valentine's Day, so we thought we'd check in on the state of marriage in America. The news is that overall, marriage is doing better than it has in a generation, at least in that divorce rates are at their lowest level since 1970. And many researchers now think that the odds of a couple staying married for life are better than half. And while the number of unmarried couples living together is also up, some groups like gays and lesbians, of course, are knocking at the door of marriage trying to get in. So what is the future of marriage in modern America? Our next guest, historian Stephanie Kunz, says to understand the future, you have to know its past. She teaches history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and is director of research and public education for the Council on Contemporary Families. Her latest book is Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. Stephanie, welcome.
Thank you.
And I just, you know, I realized when I said, hey, the odds of staying together are better than half, there are some people who are thinking, and that's, you know, joy, because better than half still seems terrible to people, but that's good because?
Well, it's good because in the 1970s, we did have that great big increase in divorce rates where half of all marriages were ending in divorce. We now think it's about 45% that will end in divorce. Mm-hmm. But a couple things to modify that. First of all, if you make it to your 21st wedding anniversary, you got more chance than ever before to making it to your 50th because people are living longer.
Mm-hmm.
And the averages are different for different people. The averages are brought up by higher divorce rates among people who marry young, people without college educations, people who are in economic stress. College-educated couples have about a 30% divorce rate. So that's pretty good compared to what we've had.
Well, so it does. There are different parts of the economic strata maybe affected by this. Fill out some more of this picture. What are some of the other numbers?
Well, one thing we know is that marriage rates have gone down. Now, that doesn't mean that marriage is dead. Most people will eventually marry. We think 85 to 90% of Americans will marry. That's down from the 95% rates of the 1950s, but it's pretty much in line with historical norms of 100 years ago. So one thing that's happening, though, is that marriage is occurring much later.
People are marrying later.
Yes.
And
that means some good things and some challenges. For one thing, it means that when marriages are postponed into their 30s, you have a much larger proportion of women who are at risk or at choice of having an unwed birth, either because of an accident or because they say, gosh, you know, my biological clock is ticking faster than my marital clock. So, the good news for older people is that it's never been more easy to find a mate at an older age.
For women as well as men? Because statistically, you know, you hear you're more likely to have an asteroid fall on you or something.
Absolutely wrong. That was wrong when that statistic came out, and it's been getting wronger and wronger, if I may say.
And by the way, you say that the picture you're painting is similar for most of the industrialized world. You have figures from Ireland and China, pretty much the same. And now let's turn to the look back, because you say there's a paradox at work here, that we can't go back to our grandparents, great-grandparents' day, when it was expected that everyone got married, and it was, you know, pretty early at that. Some people romanticize that, but on the other hand, when it does work, marriage today is more fair and fulfilling for both partners.
Yes, I think that's the huge paradox that we have to wrap our heads around. You know, for thousands of years, marriage wasn't even about love at all, and young people had very little choice. It was only 200 years ago that we started saying, oh, well, we should let people choose their own mates and on the basis of love. This was very shocking to social conservatives of the day. But even after that happened, marriage was very unequal. You know, women, for example, really had to get married because they had so few options outside it, legally and economically. As late as 1967, two-thirds of college women, only 5% of college men, but two-thirds of college women said that they'd consider marrying someone they didn't love if he had the right criteria. And we know from so many oral histories that women stayed in marriages that were actually miserable because they didn't think they had alternatives.
They were chattel. They, you know, were owned literally by their husband.
Well, as in the 19th century, you had these nice romantic marriage vows about, you know, the man taking care of the woman. But in fact, when a woman entered married, the man owned all the property that she brought to marriage, including her jewels, anything she earned within it. He had the right until the late 19th century to imprison her, to raise his hand against her. And as late as the 1970s, most American states had head and master laws giving men the final say in houses, in where you should live, if your wife could take a job, this sort of thing. So in the last 35 years, we've turned all that on its head. And I think what's happened is that when a marriage works, it works better for everybody than ever before.
Better than, as you said, back in the day when, even in Western societies, because, you know, people sort of apply this to other societies, marriage was more about picking the right in-laws, not the right partner. But what do you say to social conservatives in particular who says that, you know, who remember, you know, the old days differently? They feel that the two-parent, you know, to them it conjures up the image of the two-parent family, and that it's better for children to be raised the way things used to be.
Well, you know, actually, parents today are spending more time with their kids than they were in the 1950s, 60s, at the height of what many people consider to be the so-called traditional family. I think raising kids out of divorce or single parenthood is a challenge, but it's also important to remember that many kids are doing better. For example, in the last 15, 20 years, we've seen a huge decline in teen pregnancy rates, one little uptick last year, but still 30% lower than in 1990. Huge decline in teen violence, even as all these family forms have changed. And so you have to look more closely than just say, oh, one family form produces good outcomes, one produces bad. Two cooperating parents who respect each other and respect their kids, well, I think that's as good as it gets.
Well,
but you don't always get that.
Well, in fact, we should say we spoke to David Frum recently. He's the former advisor and speechwriter to President Bush, now highly critical Republican voice. And he said, he echoed what you have said in your research, that, yes, divorce may have come down for people in the upper income brackets, but things are different for the poor, young, people marrying poor and young. And perhaps the takeaway from this is that they need more help in being informed about what they're doing.
Well, there's two different approaches that we're seeing in the political debates today. Some people say, well, the reason that they're poor is because they're not married, and if we could just get young women to marry young men, that they'd be better off. But in fact, that's not true.
Huh.
Non-marriage and divorce are as much a product of poverty and economic instability as they are a result of it. So my take is very much what you suggested, that yes, these couples, they need help trying to figure out what the new rules of marriage are now that it requires more negotiation and more work on both parts. But they also need help to get the kind of jobs that allow them to get economic stability and to have a family wage.
Stephanie Kuntz teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. Her book is Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. Professor Kuntz, thanks so much.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
And don't forget, before we go today, choreographer Bill T. Jones, you're listening to Here and Now. Well, have you ever fallen in love with a supermarket? I mean with a product. And then they discontinue the product. Well, you're not alone. It happens often to shoppers at Trader Joe's. That's the Southern California-based eclectic grocery store chain known for its laid-back atmosphere, private label products, cheap wines, and, as producer Karen Fritchie explains, for breaking customers' hearts.
I'm in the tea section of my neighborhood Trader Joe's in Silver Lake. I'm looking for my favorite chai tea. They have black mango, raspberry infused, and blueberry green teas, but my Indian masala chai in the red box is gone. One of the managers here told me a few months ago it was discontinued, but I'm having a hard time accepting that. So each time I go back, I check again. It was the best chai I've ever had. I used to drink it every single morning. Now, I'm not sure how to start my day. My best friend, Lark Cobb, has been burned twice. She's still mourning a taqueria salsa they discontinued 3 years ago. And on top of that, she too misses the Indian masala chai.
I just have to say, why? Why? Why would you discontinue chai tea? Everyone and their brother drinks chai tea now. And that tea was really good. It had more black pepper in it than other chai teas. And I'm a chai tea connoisseur. I don't know why they would do something like that.
Don't even ask for whom the bell tolls. My next-door neighbor, Jason Mandel, says every time he goes shopping, he's worried he's next.
My favorite product is probably the Parlano pizza. And there was a time a few weeks ago where I walked in to get it and it wasn't on the shelf. And I flipped out. It was inappropriate, but I didn't know what to do.
Next message.
I just have to tell you that I had my first traumatic Trader Joe's discontinued experience just about a minute ago. I was looking for these focaccia rolls that make great hamburger buns. And it's like it turns the hamburger into like something that's like gourmet and amazing. And they weren't there, and I just knew. I just, the second I didn't see them, I knew. And I asked the guys, like, yeah, they're discontinued. I was like, well, are there any chance of bringing it back? He's like, there has to be a tremendous outcry. And I'm like, it's not even funny. I'm not laughing. Like, I'm just f***ing unhappy. Okay, bye.
I talked with customers at stores in South Pasadena, Glendale, and Silver Lake, and the story was the same. I miss my chocolate-dusted walnuts. What happened to the fresh lasagna? Bring back the ginger beer. We are extremely attached to our products, and when that bond is broken, it hurts.
And there's no one to talk to about it either. You ask the people, the really friendly Trader Joe's people in the Hawaiian shirts, and they just say, oh, you know, sometimes we do that. I don't know. I don't know why. And, you know, what can you say to that? Let me talk to your manager.
I decided to get some answers. I went to the Trader Joe's headquarters in Monrovia. It's a plain one-story white building with no sign out front. John Bossolone is Trader Joe's Senior Vice President of Marketing. He's heard my complaint before.
Well, it is a difficult situation that we come across. And actually, I'm still trying to recover from the pasta mix that was discontinued 15 years ago. But really, the way that we've been able to grow is that each product has to earn its place on the shelf.
Sometimes, he says, they discontinue products because of problems with a supplier, because food trends change. But ultimately, it's the bottom line. If a product isn't doing well, it's out. Only twice have customers' complaints brought back products. Once for a Thai peanut sauce, once for an enchilada sauce.
I realize that there'll be individuals out there who absolutely love certain products that get discontinued. Hopefully they'll just continue to search the aisles and find their next favorite item and not worry too much about what has gone by.
Is Bossolone a Trader Joe's marketing guy or a relationship counselor? Maybe it's the same thing. Falling in love with a product is sort of like dating. I'll never get over my high school heartthrob Hudson. But he got over me. And I've certainly sampled new products, I mean boyfriends, in the years since, whether I wanted to or not. So maybe Hudson was my hot chai, and Mr. 8 Long Years was my frozen edamame. With any luck at all, there's a sweet Earl Grey right around the corner.
Okay, we're going to take a quick minute break, and then we have, before that, we have a homework assignment for you. If you could, what would you ask the presidential candidates about science? If you have a thought, email us at here-now.org. That's here-now.org. Back in a minute. Here and now.
Bill T. Jones has won almost every award granted to an American choreographer, including a MacArthur Genius Grant and a Tony Award last year for dances in the musical Spring Awakening. He began his career in the relative obscurity of the downtown New York dance community, creating groundbreaking dances that question gender and racial identity. At 56, he is a striking presence on stage and an artist who seeks to challenge. From humble beginnings as the 10th son of migrant workers, he built his company, the Bill T. Jones Arnie Zane Dance Company, into an internationally recognized troupe which will soon celebrate its 25th year. They're currently touring the U.S. performing works such as Chapel Chapter. In this scene, a dancer remembers a friend from camp tumbling silently, almost beautifully, over a waterfall.
I don't really know how he got in the water, but he was down below me, and I didn't know what to do. If he, you know, if he had slipped or if he had jumped, and before I knew it, he just had calmly turned over and let himself drift right over the edge of the waterfall.
As a dancer does that, Bill T. Jones joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Very good to be here.
Can we ask you first about Chapel Chapter? You take actual court depositions from two murder cases and then the camp story that I referenced.
Mm-hmm.
You have actors and singers and dancers recite and dance. Mm-hmm. In the camp story, do we understand that one of your dancers actually confessed, that's not the right word, actually...
Well, I'll tell you how it happened. The company is a place wherein I'm constantly trying to get people to discover something about themselves or maybe talents they have, or I'll look at a young dancer or a dancer that's maybe aging, and I wonder what they have on their mind that would really help them go in a direction that's going to develop them. One dancer, his name is Charlie Scott. I sense there was a very great intelligence there. He's a wonderful dancer. And I understand that he was writing. So I said, well, I'd like to see some of your writings. And he sent me a number of things about a relative in World War II. And this story was one of those things. And it was so devastating what it was, and it was so casually stated.
Of the boy who goes over the waterfall.
About his friend Cameron. It was called Chapel Chapter for a reason. I wanted it to be about the process of judgment, but also the process of narrative, how we tell, how we remember things. And in this case, it happens to be difficult things. So Charlie was being asked to be a writer, actually, in that moment.
Well, and it's intriguing. You included, again, you intertwine it at points with the two murder stories. But what happened to the boy? Did he die?
Well, I don't really want to say too much about it. I think there is an element of suspense in the piece about it, but it's very clear that this story is grouped with other stories that don't end well.
Yeah, there you go.
No, so let's put it that way.
Leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've been talking about a story involving our colleague, producer Emiko Tamagawa, an actor who auditioned for you in the early 90s for a piece called Last Supper at Uncle Tom's Cabin, The Promised Land. She got the part and so, with other performers, was naked in the final production. But she's still talking about how wonderful an experience the audition was.
The audition here in Boston was probably one of the most remarkable experiences of my life in terms of the professional world, in that we asked for a wide variety of people. We wanted the big, the tall, the round, the skinny. We wanted the Asian. We wanted black. We wanted the demographic of the city that we were in. We wanted them all to be present there. She was one of them. But what was remarkable that day was that there were about 75 women. And I remember, I actually, for some reason, danced with every one of them one-on-one. Now, that's when I think about it, knowing how my back is these days and my knees, that was quite a feat, but it was absolutely appropriate for the moment, and I've never forgotten it, and obviously she has not either.
No.
And when we ever meet each other now, those of us who were involved in Uncle Tom's Cabin, about 800 people actually did that over a couple of years in 35 cities. There's always an embrace, which we call the Uncle Tom's Cabin embrace, because we really bonded around that experience. There was a stage of naked people of every description, bathed in a golden light and singing Julius Hempel's, what he called, children's song in the voices of children. And that was my vision of paradise.
Hmm.
I say art making is a spiritual activity. And I'm not a religious person, but I'm a person who believes there's an invisible thing that connects us. You might call it your intention, you might call it gravity, what have you. And I believe that people have to know that where their limits are, where their boundaries are what are you afraid of? You're obviously here because you want to be seen. And if you want to be seen, you can't control how you're seen. So at this moment, show me yourself. And that's what happened in an audition. They were not naked, but there is something very naked about a person who's not a dancer being asked to move for no other reason than to move. Mm. That's naked.
Yeah. For some people, just the stage is nakedness. A few years later, in 1994, you landed in the middle of an incendiary debate when New Yorker dance critic Arlene Croce objected to a piece you created called Still Here. At this point, you'd been HIV positive since 1985. Luckily, that never progressed to AIDS, but your partner, Arnie, died of AIDS in 1988. Your piece drew from videos you'd made with terminally ill people. Now, Croce refused to even see the piece, but condemned it anyway as victim art. Looking back, it seems so quaint, and it's hard to understand why it was an issue for her to make art about illness.
Because it was an issue of its time, and I think it had a lot to do with anxiety in the culture about the discourse, I call it, who was allowed to actually define what is allowed on stage. And someone might say, why are you demanding that we look at them? Well, I'm not demanding that you look at them.
Right.
You choose to come in and look at them because, quite frankly, they are us. And that was what maybe Still Here caused anxiety and on the part of certain people who want to see art as primarily an issue of connoisseurship, something transcending the this two solid flesh that we're all composed of. And they felt that I was being aggressive for reasons that had to be self-interested and angry in making them complicit in it. And I was saying, this is the poetry of our era, this difference, these troubling questions. Yes, the AIDS problem was with us then, as it is now, but quite frankly, the piece was encouraged in me by a woman here from the Boston area whose name was Sunny Dupree, who was a breast cancer activist, who actually challenged me. She said that you should make a piece about breast cancer. I said, I don't know anything about it. I'm a man, a gay man. She said, that's why you should do it. You know, you've heard about the arrogance of the young. Well, there's an arrogance of the well, as if you could not know anything about what's going to happen to us all. And we are not free of that anxiety right now. I don't know if you've been following our latest election around issues of who would think at this point that, quote, a man who is a father, who is a Kenyan, a mother who is white, suddenly he gets neatly put into the category of being a black candidate.
Do you feel a dance coming on, Bill T. Jones, regarding the current political scene?
Well, I have a dance to do tonight with my company. That dance is called Chapel Chapter, which is trying to talk about us sitting in the court of public opinion, but not really having to pay anything to be there.
Which is where we began and which is where, coming full circle, we will leave off. Choreographer Bill T. Jones directs the Bill T. Jones Arnie Zane Dance Company. Thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you very much.